Well, for those of you who did not hear at the beginning of class, today we are going to be talking about NMR. And it's in fact going to be all reviewed today, pretty much. Because I discovered yesterday with the other two sections just how much NMR had been forgotten. I kind of described it as the aerodynamics of understanding. You know, it approaches you, you see it oncoming, and it just kind of goes up and over like that. Or then I said, no, it's actually more like this permeability, because it comes in one end, but then it unfortunately came out the other. So we're going to do the greatest hits of NMR, you could say, revisit the main topics from last quarter, take all those lectures, condense them down. If you need to review, those lectures are still online, and we did do a much more in-depth discussion of each of the topics I'm going to address today. So I'm not going to reteach it. It's just going to be reviewing the core concepts, because the goal of this quarter isn't just to understand what NMR theory is or what happens in NMR, but it's to use the information that we can get from NMR to determine the structure of a compound. That's where we need to get to, or be on the way to at least, by the end of the quarter. So, to start out with, what physically is going on, not with the NMR machine, but within the NMR sample that gives rise to the spectra that we acquire? Okay, so the sample absorbs some frequencies of light, and then what happens? It is true that we could take that information to find the shape, but what causes that signal to be generated? Like, why is it that light gets absorbed? Okay, so there's a magnetic field that's involved, and there's this thing called spin that some but not all nuclei have. And in this particular case, we're looking at carbon and hydrogen, specifically protium, which is H1, and then carbon-13, because they have spin of 1/2. And that's the same 1/2 as you find in an electron spin. The reason that ends up being really convenient is that with spin 1/2, you only have those two orientations possible. With other spins, there can be multiple energy states, which doesn't mean you can't do NMR, but makes it a lot more tricky to interpret. So by only having the up or down possibility, we have one energy gap that corresponds to a particular nucleus. That nucleus can then absorb light, but only of a particular frequency. So you can zap the sample with a range of frequencies. It'll absorb only the ones that correspond to those energy gaps. And then after the power's turned off, it releases that energy again. And we get that and interpret that as the spectrum. So, again, yes?
I remember something about disturbance.
About the what?
Disturbance.
Disturbance? We're going to get to that. I think I know what you're talking about. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, I just want to get to the fundamentals of what's going on with the spin and why there's an absorption occurring. So nuclei such as H1 and C13 have spin, and specifically a spin of 1/2. This word doesn't get thrown around a lot, so I want to mention it. Protium is the name when you want to refer specifically to H1, the main form of hydrogen. And it matters because deuterium is a different nucleus, so it doesn't respond at the same frequencies that protium does. So H1 and C13 have spin 1/2. Which, just because some of you may see this again in the future, the 1/2 designation is actually incomplete. It's actually 1/2 times 1/2 2 pi over h, which is the same thing as 1/2 this symbol called h bar. The reason 2 pi comes in is because it has to do with rotation, and 2 pi is the circumference of a circle if you're in radians. That H is Planck's constant, which tells you the size of energy packets, and that's related then to spin, because spin is indirectly kind of a representation of a certain amount of energy, you could say. So nuclei with spin 1/2 are randomly arranged when not in a magnetic field, but will either align with or anti-parallel against a magnetic field once a magnetic field is present. So to draw a rough picture of this, in the case where we have no magnetic field, there's nothing really to cause those spins to want to align one way or another. Now, I'm not a physicist, so I don't recall if there's any chance the nuclei might have an influence on each other in this kind of situation, but still, on average, it's going to be randomly oriented, and there's going to be effectively, therefore, only one energy level. But then, when we do have a magnetic field, we end up with the two possibilities, spins aligned with the direction of the field or aligned opposite direction. Those each have an energy associated with it, energy levels. And we can see, compared to the randomly oriented state, we have a split in energies that occurs. That causes an energy gap to form. Now that gap, the nuclei won't necessarily all be in the lowest energy level at room temperature, because thermal energy can, in a sense, cause the nuclei to flip. So there'll be some proportion of the nuclei at the lower state and some proportion at the higher state. And actually that same e to negative something over RT factor that shows up in the Arrhenius expression, that same form of equation shows up to tell you what the proportion, the population of these two energy states is. The point of this is that if you were to add a photon, a packet of energy that exactly matches that gap, because we do have an equation that relates the two, that is frequency of light, but frequency of light that corresponds to a photon of a particular energy. That energy matches this gap, then you can excite the nuclei to be in that higher spin state, that higher energy spin state. But of course, once you turn the light off, nothing is going to hold those nuclei up permanently, and they'll start reverting back to their lower energy state. That's the release of energy that we measure. That's how the spectrum gets generated. So only when light of the right energy gap hits it do we get a response back afterwards. So if a photon with the correct energy which corresponds to light of a particular frequency. Is absorbed by the nucleus can flip from the low to high energy state. The energy released when the nucleus flips back to the low energy state is what's measured by an NMR spectrometer. Now there's, yes.
When the nucleus flips from the low to the high energy, is it lift the lower energy empty?
Well, yes, because if you only have one nucleus, it can't be two things at the same time. So if it's in the high energy state, it can't be the low energy. It's not like there's two spaces. It's one nucleus that's aligned one way or the other. So if it's flipped this way, it's not that way. Now, there are three factors that can affect that energy gap. And it matters because we're trying to measure those energy gaps. One of the factors is just what is the machine strength itself. The stronger the magnetic field of the machine, the larger the energy gap that you're going to generate. There's also the nucleus involved. Whichever particular nucleus you have has its own sensitivity to the magnetic field. So, for example, hydrogen is almost exactly 4 times more sensitive than carbon, which means the frequencies that you scan hydrogen at are 4 times that of those frequencies that you scan carbon at. There's one more general effect that can change that energy gap, and that's the most important one, usually, because we're only going to be looking at carbon and hydrogen, so it's not like we're comparing multiple nuclei. And when we run an NMR experiment, of course, we only do it on one machine. So what's the main effect that is going to change these energy gaps, and therefore change which frequencies we observe that gives us that information that lets us get a molecular structure? The chemical environment, or we can also refer to it as chemical shift. And so could you describe what happens that causes that energy gap to change?
I think it depends what solvent you're using.
Okay.
That is a very, has some electronegative atoms.
Okay.
Then they kind of shift or change this energy gap, make it bigger, I guess.
Yes, it does.
And if it's not, less electronegative, make this energy gap smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So the frequency is smaller.
Mm-hmm. So, and it's not the solvent that's going to do that per se, it's what on the same molecule is right next door to that particular nucleus. So, for example, I'm nucleus being scanned. If my neighbor next to me is really electronegative, it pulls electron density away from me, which means I experience the magnetic field as a nucleus to a greater extent. That's called deshielding. So when you deshield the nucleus, that because that nucleus feels the magnetic field in a greater sense, then that gap increases, which means you need a photon of greater energy, which means you have to have light of a higher frequency. And then, like you said, if you had something that wasn't electronegative, then you don't have that deshielding, you're shield dead, which means you would have to have a stronger magnetic field in order to get the same response, or if you were in the same magnetic field, the energy gap's going to shrink, which means a photon of less energy, which means light of a lower frequency. And that's going to show up in a bit in our discussion, because with that piece of information, chemical shift, often we can identify a functional. So that's useful information. So let's write this down. If a nucleus has an electronegative neighbor, that neighbor will pull electron density away from the nucleus, so it'll deshield that nucleus. Exposing the nucleus more greatly to the magnetic field. This causes a larger energy gap. Which means a higher frequency of light would be needed. Now, there is another use for the term chemical shift, though, which is a numeric quantity, which we represent with the symbol lowercase delta. So can someone remind me what the definition of chemical shift is in this sense? Okay, there is a difference of frequencies. The observed frequency minus machine frequency divided by the machine frequency times, well, 100 would be for percent, but this is in units of part per million, which means times a million. So chemical shift is observed frequency minus the machine frequency divided by the machine frequency times a million. Why do we care about this quantity? Why care about chemical shift like this? Why not just use frequency? That's right. Each machine's got a different magnetic field, which means you'd register a different frequency on each machine. And so it wouldn't be easy to compare from one machine to another. It'd be worthless, in fact. But by the fact that the machine field strength is directly proportional to both the observed and the machine frequencies, because the same magnetic field's operating in both cases. Well, the fact that we're taking frequency and dividing it by frequency, which buried in that means we're taking the magnetic field and dividing it by the magnetic field, we ended up with a machine-independent quantity. So that's why chemical shift is useful. What's the machine frequency? Ooh, yes. So machine frequency is the frequency we get when we measure a specific standard. which for carbon and hydrogen, there is a silicon-based standard, which is what? TMS, which, unlike what we did this quarter, does not mean trimethylsilyl. Now, we have this TMS protecting group, but TMS also stands for tetra, which means four. Tetramethylsilane, which is the compound that's used for calibration. So for protium and carbon 13, the machine frequency is determined by using the reference standard TMS, which again stands for tetramethylsilane. All right. Now, recall that in actuality, when we are acquiring these spectra, we don't really get the end product at first, or the, what we look at to interpret. Because what comes out of the sample is just a set of waves, the different frequencies of light, all stacked on top of each other. So we get this big overlapping wave that decreases over time as the nuclei relax. And that's got, again, all these different frequencies buried in it. There's this technique we can use called a Fourier transform, which is able to pick out of that combined wave each of the individual frequencies and how much, in terms of intensity, each of those frequencies is present. So once you do the Fourier transform, then we've got our spectrum, which I want to just draw an idealized picture of a spectrum so we could discuss it a bit. So the y-axis is intensity, how much signal is generated. The x-axis is chemical shift, but recall that chemical shift increases from right to left, and that's because there's a historical reason behind it. In older forms of NMR, which sometimes are still performed today, there are still applications for it, but in older systems, you might adjust the magnetic field instead of adjusting the frequency that you're trying to observe at. So if you were adjusting the magnetic field, then what you were doing is you were scanning consistently at just one frequency. Well, if you had something that was de-shielded, which means it's more exposed to the nucleus, it means you would need to decrease the magnetic field in order to get that energy gap to be correct, to be scanned at that one frequency. If you were a shielded nucleus, that means you'd have to have a stronger magnetic field to bring that energy gap up to the point where would match that particular absorbance. And so magnetic field strength on those in that older style of performing NMR was written as increasing from left to right. But because the effect is sort of opposite, you know, with the shielding you needed a bigger magnetic field. With a deshielding you needed a smaller magnetic field. If we're looking at in terms of frequency, it's opposite. If we fix the magnetic field, keep it constant, then when we have shielding, we get the smaller frequency. And when we have deshielding, we have the larger frequency. And so that's why chemical shift is plotted in the opposite direction, because there's an inverse correspondence. Now, I'm not likely to ask a question about that, but just in case you read a text and you hear the terms upfield, downfield, remember that that's where these terms come from. Now let me draw, again, an example spectrum. And now that we've got nearly everybody here, now I'll give my little miniature soapbox lecture, which is, did I or did I not warn everybody that NMR would be coming at some point this quarter? How many of you reviewed NMR at all this quarter? You must be one of the two people out of all three sections that did that. So, you do have another quarter of OChem that you're going to have to survive, that you're still going to have to know NMR4. You have the lab quiz this quarter, which is coming, and that's not going to change. And NMR is going to be on there. You have an interesting weekend ahead, I guess, to recreate in your head all these concepts that we're going on over, because this is just the background. We got to move on from this. And I know you've got other classes, and we've already got enough going on with synthesis and mechanism and molecular orbitals and kinetics versus thermodynamics, but that's why when everybody ever takes OChem, and they don't know what OChem is, they just know that people just are in terror the whole time that they're taking OChem. It's because of 12B. A is rough, yeah, but then when you, like, if you don't know nothing, then it's one kind of bad. When you know a little something and you know what kind of bad it is, then it's worse. So that's the situation in. Moral of the story, you have to review NMR this weekend. You have to, because Tuesday we're going to start doing interpretation of spectra. And if I start using terminology and start talking about chemical shift and integration and splitting and doublets and triplets and this and that, and you don't know what I'm talking about, how do you have a chance of solving a spectrum? Which, that's what the problems will be on the lab quiz. The lab quiz will almost entirely consist of kinetics versus thermodynamics and NMR. I'm just telling you what the lab quiz is, so you know exactly what to study. All that, the reaction coordinate diagrams and forward and reverse reactions and why thermo versus kinetic product forms, that's one question I get every year. And then NMR, I've done it different times in different years, but they were guaranteed NMR for this lab quiz. So, Tuesday, I expect more than just the three or four people that have been talking to be able to talk about NMR. All right, now, public service announcement over with. Let's look at the spectrum. And let's say that I have a formula of C2H5Br. I'll get back at some point to say whether or not it makes sense that the spectrum matches that formula. But let's first figure out what are the key pieces of information that we can get from the spectrum. So the chemical shift, that's the first thing we could notice. And again, that tells us something about the functional group. If it's for hydrogen, if it's 10 or greater, it's almost automatically an aldehyde or carboxylic acid. If it's between 6.5 and 8, it's probably a hydrogen on a benzene ring. If it's from 4 to 6-ish, it's probably alkene. From 2 to 4, an alcohol. If it's around 2, it could be next to a ketone. Of course, if the ketone, you wouldn't have it on the carbonyl, but next to it. And then below 2, it's probably some form of halide or just alkane. There's a chart in your text, actually, that has a whole bunch of different environments for hydrogens. And you can use that chart to try to guess what functional group that you have. Now, the types of problems I'll be giving you, you'll have a chemical formula. So you won't be going to that chart and looking at every single absorbance. Because if you don't have oxygen, you wouldn't look at the chart for anything that has oxygen in it, for example. But therefore, you can use those charts to figure out, to guess, structural patterns, motifs that you have. Because if you know, for example, that you have an oxygen and maybe you have something that shows up next to a ketone, well, then you know you've got a carbonyl. So that way you get little hints and that lets you solve the structure. So chemical shift is one of the things that is important. And that, again, could be useful in identifying the form of functional group that you have. What's another piece of information? Okay, we have splitting. And what's the last one? Integrals. Which is proportional for hydrogen NMR to the number of hydrogens. Turns out it's not as useful in carbon NMR, largely because there's only 1/100th the amount of carbon versus hydrogen in an average sample, at least that responds because it's spin 1/2. But for hydrogens, it's useful. But notice I say it's proportional, not equal. Because, for example, if you had the compound cyclohexane, which at room temperature only has one type of hydrogen, and cyclopentane, which, again, at room temperature only has one type of hydrogen, then if you only have one hydrogen, you're going to only get one signal out of it. And so if you have these two different samples, that if you didn't know their concentrations, and you just took the absorbances, you're going to get this number from the machine that's some form of intensity. But how can you relate that at all to how many hydrogens you have around? The answer is you can't. Unless you know the concentration of your sample, and unless you put in a reference like TMS that you also know the concentration of, then you could do a quantitative measurement. But when normally won't even be worrying about that with these problems, because normally I'm just going to give you the intervals. Because I at this point, again, we're trying to move to focus on structure, not what is an interval. Now then there's splitting, which splitting comes from what? The fact that if you're observing one nucleus, you've got another neighbor or two or three that are going to interact with the magnetic field that that nucleus is going to experience. So for example, if you have a neighbor that is aligned the same way as the magnetic field is, well then I'm going to still feel the general magnetic field, but I'm also, because I'm so close to this one, going to feel the magnetic field coming from over here. And they're going to add to each other, which is going to increase my energy gap. But maybe at some point that neighbor's pointed the opposite way instead. So although I've got the main magnetic field that I'm experiencing, now this one is subtracting from it, canceling it, just locally, but I'm local, so it's affecting me. Statistically, both of those possibilities are going to occur, not simultaneously on the same molecule, but we got billions of molecules in a sample. So at the same time, what used to have been a single signal will be split and generate two peaks right next close to each other, which we call a doublet. As we'll see in a moment, if you have an additional equal neighbor, then we'll have a triplet. Three neighbors, a quartet. That's this N plus one rule that we learned last quarter. So splitting is useful because the other information is talking about the position that's being scanned. But if you know something about what's being scanned and what's next to it, then you can start piecing together which is the neighbor of which, and that way you eventually end up with the structure of the molecule. So splitting. Gives information about neighbors. So now that we know what the three main factors or the three pieces of information we're going to use are, let's go back to the spectrum and see if it makes sense that that this would match a compound like C2H5Br. First, let me ask you, was this spectrum obtained in a chiral or an achiral solvent? Just heard chiral and achiral. Well, why does it matter? Because how many homeotopic and enantiotopic or diastereotopic protons does this compound have? Yes, you still need to know those terms from last quarter. What do those terms mean? Homotopic means that if you were to replace one of the hydrogens at that position, it would not change the structure, or you wouldn't generate multiple possible structures. There would be no stereocenter involved. The reason the potential to make the stereocenter even matters is because if you have something over here but pointing only one way that's electronegative, and if I had one hydrogen that's closer to it versus one hydrogen that's further away from it on the same position, well, they're going to have different chemical shifts. They're going to have different chemical environments. Now, if you don't have the potential to make a stereocenter, that means all the hydrogens are going to be equivalent no matter what you do. So those homotopic protons, it doesn't matter what solvent that you're in, they'll never split. That would be what we have with the methyl group in this compound. Because if you say methyl group, there's three of that hydrogen there. And if you replace one with some random group X, you still don't have a stereocenter, which means you wouldn't have any difference in the interaction with that position with any neighbor it has. So we ignore it. Now, what about the other hydrogens? If we were to place one of these, which after the other lectures, I realized I needed to not just color but label these. If we look at the HB hydrogens, if we replace one of those versus the other, what would we generate? Well, a stereocenter, but specifically in terms of the molecules that we would make, what kind of molecules would we make? Chiral, but what would be the relationship between the molecules that would be generated? I can't quite hear you. They would be enantiomers. And so we therefore call these enantiomtopic protons. Why do those matter? Because in achiral solvents, they actually don't matter. But in chiral solvents, then you're in that particular situation. If you have a stereocenter where you have a hydrogen pointing one way and some other functional group the other way, and then you have a chiral solvent that has a particular arrangement to it as well, well, then you're going to have differing interactions with different sides of the molecules. So in chiral solvents, HBs, those would be different from each other. But in an achiral solvent, they would be the same. The number of different hydrogens is the number of different NMR signals. We have two NMR signals that match these two hydrogens, so it means that this was acquired in an achiral solvent. There is one more relationship, just to remind you, of diastereotopic protons. That if you replace one position and you could form diastereomers, then those are called diastereotopic protons, which are always potentially different from each other. Now, leaving that little bit of history behind, let's again look at this and see if this matches up. So I have two hydrogens and three hydrogens. I have an integration of two and an integration of three. So we might think that the two corresponds to HB, the ones that are in red, and the three would correspond to the HA, the ones that I've written in blue. Does that make sense? Well, look at the groups of peaks there. These multiplets get formed because of splitting. The HA hydrogens, the blue ones, are split into a triplet. And if you look, they only have two neighbors. So that matches, in fact. Two neighbors would make a triplet. In turn, the red hydrogens, the one that integrates two, they have three neighbors, which is why that's split into a quartet. So that does match. Now, since next time we're going to go from this spectral information to a structure, let's prepare for that by taking a structure and seeing if we can predict what its spectrum is going to look like. Any questions before I move on? Yeah.
When you say HB, it's both HB.
Yes, they are. Well, depending on the solvent, since I'm saying this was an achiral solvent, then they are the same as each other, yes. So, here's the example molecule I want to use. In achiral solvents, which I'll admit, 99% of the time, we're only going to be discussing things in achiral solvents. So normally, you're not going to have to worry about the whole homotopic, enantiotopic, diastereotopic problem. Although, you can't totally ignore it, but we will most of the time. How many different types of hydrogens would there be on this molecule then? How many different types of hydrogens? I heard an answer from somewhere. It is four. Because if you don't worry about the possibility of making stereocenters, we have one hydrogen where the chlorine is. I'll call that HA. We have two hydrogens on the position next to it, which would be the same. I'll just refer to one of them as HB. Then next position over, same situation. Two hydrogens would be equivalent, which I'll call HC. And then we have the methyl group on the other side of the ketone, which I'll call HD. I want to point out, and we'll return to this point in a moment, there are no hydrogens on the carbonyl. Why does that matter? Well, you can't split if you don't have neighbors. So notice that the red hydrogens have no neighbors, so they're going to have no splitting. Actually, let's just look at that first pair, of that first set of hydrogens. Because what I'd like to do is show you how you'd express the spectral information that would come from this. Three pieces of information we have: chemical shift, splitting, and integration. And that's the order that generally that the information's listed in. Now, where could we get the chemical shift of a hydrogen like that? In that table that's in your lab text, or there's also a compilation of chemical shifts that I've got a copy of somewhere in my office. I think it's the same sheet that's been passed around for decades now. Someone somewhere compiled a bunch of these absorbances. And it turns out that for a methyl group on a ketone, it generally shows up around 2.0, 2.1, something like that. For simplicity's sake, let's just say it's 2.0. As I said a moment ago, there'll be no splitting, which is super important. Because if you have a singlet, the only way that that's possible is by having something next to you that doesn't have any hydrogens on it. And if you can clearly identify you have possibly a methyl group, you know, if it integrates to have three hydrogens, three hydrogens with a singlet is almost always a methyl group attached to a carbonyl, attached to an oxygen, attached to a quaternary carbon, one that has no hydrogens on it. So knowing you have that blocking occurring often lets you solve very quickly the structure of a compound because it limits the types of structures that are possible. Yes?
It's an S for singlet. 2.0, comma, S, comma, 1H. The S, the singlet, means one peak and no splitting is occurring.
That's a little better. Let's go to the green hydrogens, HC, next. So it turns out that when you have carbon as a neighbor, there ends up being a slight electron withdrawing effect that occurs. So the chemical shift for the green hydrogens is going to be a little bit higher than the red ones. And based on the tables, I'm going to guesstimate that it shows up at about chemical shift 2.3. And what would be the splitting that would occur? Triplet. Because one neighbor would cause the one absorbance to be split into two. The next neighbor would cause each of those to split. But since it's the same neighbors, when they split a second time, from those two peaks, you get one peak, but with double the intensity. You also get a pair of peaks on either, well, you get a peak on either side of it. So one first splits into two, then splits into three, a triplet. We're going to write one of these splitting trees out in a moment to review this idea. There's only two hydrogens there, so it should integrate to two. Now let's skip over the HB, the blue ones, because that's going to be the trickiest one. Let's go to HA. So HA is right next to, or some of you have actually learned this term because I've seen a couple of you use it on quizzes or such, you could say alpha to the chlorine position. There's only one hydrogen there. It's going to have a lot of electron withdrawing around it. And so, based on the tables, this had a chemical shift of somewhere around 5.3. It's got two neighbors just like the green hydrogens did, so it will also be a triplet. And again, it's only going to integrate to one because there's only one hydrogen at that position. Now let's look at the blue hydrogens. And let's write a splitting tree, an explanation for the splitting that we would observe. So if HB were all by itself, had no neighbors whatsoever, you would only generate one signal. But if I had one of the HCs that interact with it, then it splits for the reasons that I was describing earlier, that neighbor, that HC, might be up or down, which then would affect the magnetic field that experienced by HB. That distance between those two peaks has what's called a coupling constant. So I've labeled it JBC because it represents the extent of interaction between B and C. If we throw one more neighbor in, then each of these two peaks that we just made is going to themselves split. But because it's being split by the same neighbor, HC, the coupling constant is identical again. And just a little bit of very simple math. If you have JB and it equally splits this first peak, then that means half of it's that way, half of it's that way. When it splits again, half's going to come back, which means it'll be in the same position that HB was to begin with. And it'll happen from both directions. And so that's why we end up with something like this. So notice that in terms of intensity, we now have a pattern of 1, 2, 1. If we had another neighbor that was exactly the same, we would then have a pattern of 1, 3, 3, 1. If we have another neighbor, 1, 4, 6, 4, 1. This is Pascal's triangle, like we had discussed last quarter. But this is different from last quarter. Because last quarter we just said, if you know how many neighbors you have, add 1 to that, and that'll tell you how many peaks you end up with. We didn't talk about the fact that what if you have two different kind of neighbors? Because look at HC, the one in green, look at HA, the one in purple. Two totally different chemical environments. One that's next to a ketone, one that's next to two halogens. So their coupling constants are very likely going to be different. Let's imagine if the coupling constant between A and B is much smaller than the coupling constant than between B and C. Then when we throw HA at it, again, each one of the peaks we had is going to split. But now there's no coalescence, there's no overlap that occurs because the coupling constants are different. So you start out with a singlet. With one neighbor, you make a doublet. With one more equivalent neighbor, you make a triplet. But now with this different neighbor, each part of that triplet has made a doublet. And so depending on exactly which one is more prevalent, we could call this a triplet of doublets, or the fact that we had a triplet that got split, we could call it a doublet of triplets. When you use a symbol like that, that specifically means you have two different neighbors. Again, that's useful information. If I know that I have just a triplet, then I know that maybe I'm up against a ketone like this, and I can only have splitting on one side. If I know I have a doublet of triplets, that automatically means I got neighbors at least on two sides of them. Possibly three if it's a symmetric molecule, but those will be tricks that we learn later. So, going back to the blue hydrogen, it'll have a chemical shift of roughly 2.5. It'll be a doublet of triplets that integrates to 2. Now, how do we work the problem in reverse? You start with that and the chemical formula. And that's what we're going to do on Tuesday. Questions? Aside from, can we just make NMR go away? Then, as far as what you need to accomplish today, we obviously have a bunch more melting points to do. Again, the same disclaimer that if you make any solids today, you really, really, really need to let them dry out. So whether you want to air dry them, possibly use the oven, or just wait till next time. I know that we're supposed to start another lab next time, but my recollection is it's another one of those shake and bake labs. So we should easily have time to continue doing melting points. And then still those of you who have labs 3 or 4 that you need to do, still give a priority to this current lab first. Because again, I hadn't gone over the lab report, so again, they're still not due. And I'd rather complete an experiment at the risk of pushing those due dates out even a little further. So focus on the melting points. And then, and once you're done, go back and finish off labs 3 and 4 if you need to. Let's go ahead and get to work.